You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
Welcome to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We give voice to those who challenge a prevailing sentiment in global financial markets. This podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests were not compensated for their appearance, nor do they supply payment in order to appear. Individuals on this podcast may hold positions in the securities that are discussed. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. This podcast episode may have ads and the occasional announcement. To listen without ads or announcements and take advantage of a host of other benefits, consider becoming a premium subscriber. Prices start at $9 per month. Visit the website contrarian.supercast.tech. That's TECH for more information. Now, here's your host, Mr. Nathaniel E. Baker.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Merck Research. MerckResearch.com, M-E-R-K. I read these reports on a regular basis and can say that I get a lot of value out of them. Merck Research is different from other research, which usually just cherry picks all positive or all negative charts and then falls into the trap of confirmation bias. Merck Research provides an intellectually consistent approach by going through a consistent set of relevant data and then putting it through a consistent set of frameworks, which is then summarized in a checklist and in a concise written summary. Their monthly economic and market data review provides an excellent overview of the macro landscape. It's all compiled in one place and easy to interpret chart books with written analysis. And now listeners of this podcast can take advantage of a special offer and get a three-month free trial to Merck Research. Simply visit the website merckresearch.com/contrarian. That's Merck spelled M-E-R-K. Or you can log on to merckresearch.com, sign up for a regular subscription, and enter the code contrarian at checkout to take advantage of this free offer. Now on to today's episode. Ethan Wydell, a senior analyst over at Ironhold Capital Management. We are here to talk about the case for India and Indian stocks. Now, this is an interesting country, a very interesting market. And from a contrarian perspective, of course, we are interested in this because it has not really gone anywhere this year, while the U.S. stocks have advanced quite a bit. Now, there are some concerns about India right now over rising coronavirus cases, which is probably weighing on investors' sentiment quite a bit. But your firm, if I'm not mistaken, focuses on Indian securities. But before we get there, and maybe just start and tell me a little bit about the case for Indian stocks in general.
Absolutely. So here at Ironhold Capital, we invest really heavily in both the United States and India. And while we are value investors, we're not really macro investors. We do think that the macroeconomic positioning of India is really extraordinary, and the long-term tailwinds for the whole country are really conducive to growth. For one, the country has a GDP growth of about 6 to 7%. It's the largest democracy in the world, the second most populous country in the world. And it has a massive amount of inefficiency in the stock market. And so it's a great place for professional investors to look for ideas, COVID notwithstanding.
Yeah, we'll get around to the COVID a bit, but let's talk a little more big picture first. Now, India has traditionally been kind of not really a manufacturing economy. It is domestic consumer based. But talk to me about some of the transitions that are going on there right now.
Absolutely. Well, actually, about 50% of the Indian workforce is still agrarian.
Okay.
Still employed in the agricultural sector. And while we've seen that decline recently, since the 90s, when India first began to really open itself up to the free market and to a more deregulated economy, we've seen a little bit of a shift away from agriculture and more towards manufacturing and the service economy. But it's really an interesting economy because so much of the workforce is still agrarian. Like by comparison, only 2% of the US is employed in agriculture. So we see this very agrarian economy, which is like totally on the opposite end of the spectrum from the high-tech service economy that occupies, you know, the other side of the Indian economy. But recently, with more efforts to sort of shift away from this agrarian sector, we are seeing higher growth in the service economy, higher growth in the manufacturing economy, and those are starting to become competitive with other emerging economies like China.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very interesting. Now, one, you know, you might call it a disadvantage that democracies have is bureaucracy. And in India, as anybody who's ever been there, who's, and I have, not that much, but a little bit. And there is actually a lot of red tape. And for a developing economy, there's a lot of bureaucracy. And I know that Modi had his initiative Make in India a couple of years ago, which I guess has kind of undermined some of the trends that you're talking about, has led to more of this manufacturing. But infrastructure, of course, is still a problem. And like I said, with the red tape, it's hard to get a lot of infrastructure projects going. We've seen that here in the US, of course, much more so. But what can you say about that and that being kind of one of the big barriers to really letting India get up to full speed to where it would really be cranking on all cylinders?
Well, it's true, and that is a concern. I think that that's definitely a concern for all democracies. Mm-hmm. India historically has been somewhat more regulated than the US and, you know, certain economies that we see in Europe. But the long-term trend tends to be towards deregulation. And I think that the major thing that you get for an emerging market with their democratic structure, well, you might have to put up with some red tape and you might have to put up with some regulation and you'll have to put up with oftentimes some government ownership in a lot of public companies, which we generally see as a negative. What you get is more reliable governments. It's more predictable, where with China, with the communist government, and not to talk too much about politics, but we find that it's just unpredictable. You don't know when the government is going to, you know, totally bar large companies from operating or from operating fully. With India, you see more free market forces. Mm-hmm. And because of that, we can actually make better predictions about where a company is going to go in the future. So that allows us to navigate some of the red tape and the regulations better.
Interesting. And you spoke of it, the securities market there and investing in India. And I want to talk in a little bit about some of the ideas you have for investors to the best way for them to access it. But the one of the ways in which the regulation has been seen is in the securities market.
Absolutely.
It's very regulated. I know from covering the hedge fund sector in Asia, not much in India because there aren't any hedge funds there, because it's shorting, at least was until recently, I think, you know, completely illegal, which is not unique to India. I mean, there's a lot of other countries that have that, but there is a thriving options market. I know that, but as far as the regulations and the again, the red tape that's keeping investors on the sidelines and such, is that something that is also being worked on or that you've seen?
Yes. One of the major sort of barriers to global entry into the Indian market is that historically, you basically had to be a Indian citizen or a person of Indian descent living abroad. And that's still the case for individual investors. Like, it's very hard if, you know, I want to go and, you know, open a trading account in India. It would be very hard for me to do that. But what they have done more recently is start to allow in more foreign institutional investors. And this is sort of allowed for more direct investment from the United States and other foreign countries that are interested in getting in on the Indian space. For everybody else, though, there are a number of index funds and ETFs that retail investors can, yeah, put their money into.
Interesting. And so what, yeah, I mean, we're obviously not in the business of recommending any individual stocks here, but as far as these ETFs, are they a fair gauge of the broader market, you would say? Like, if like a retail investor in the US just wanted to get access to the Indian stock market and the Indian economy, is buying the iShares, is that a good option or what?
Sure. Well, I think that the BSE Sensex and the Nifty 50 are really the two best collection of securities to look at. They serve as a pretty good alternative to investing in the S&P 500. They serve kind of a similar function as being an index of the largest stocks in the Indian economy. And overall, we've seen good returns. You know, COVID notwithstanding, of course, we've really seen COVID cases just spike terribly in India in the last few months. But overall, we see that as a short-term issue and something that the Indian economy and Indian companies are going to overcome with time.
Okay, cool. Yeah, and speak to that a little bit. I mean, the headlines that we've seen here are all about this, you know, disaster cases for rising coronavirus cases and deaths and such, and lack of distribution on vaccines and all these other things. I know that headline writers need to do their thing, but what is the real, like, from your guys' perspective, like, how bad is it? And do you see things getting better, and how soon?
Well, it's definitely a concern. And from a sort of more humanitarian view, it's really troubling to see that only, I think, 8% of Indian population has received one vaccine. From a more business-oriented and fundamental perspective, we've seen most companies have already adjusted, and we're seeing the fundamentals pick back up. And despite the uptick in cases, business is starting to go back to usual. So we are confident that for the investor, it isn't a long-term worry.
Cool. So maybe it is a good opportunity to buy then at this point, considering.
I think so. There's always a ton of inefficiency in the Indian market. You know, there are, in the US, there are fewer than 4,000 publicly listed companies that are watched by, I think, over 10,000 active management funds between mutual funds and hedge funds. Whereas in India, there are almost 8,000 companies that are followed by fewer than 500 active funds. So really, there are fewer eyes on the market. And for us, that means more opportunities to find inefficiency, to find good buy-in points, and to exploit any sort of inefficiencies that we're able to find.
Nice. Very cool. And within that, talk to me about some of the sectors maybe that you're most excited about within the Indian market.
Absolutely. Well, one sector that we're tremendously excited about is finance, financial markets, mutual funds in particular. And part of that is because of discretionary income, which has really quadrupled every time the GDP has doubled. We basically see that there are more and more Indian citizens that are interested in investing in the stock market and investing in mutual funds. And the popularity as a percent of savings has doubled just in the last 5 years or so. So overall, we're seeing like a 15 to 20% annual growth in the industry in general. And we're seeing just a massive increase in the popularity and the sophistication of these mutual funds.
Very cool. And now are these are managed by local companies?
Yes.
Yeah. So it's not like, Fidelity is there, or Vanguard or any of these guys. Or
maybe there are, and there is some international corporate presence in India in the financial space. We see it particularly in investment banking, but as far as mutual funds are concerned, the largest ones and the most successful, most growing ones are Indian managed.
And these are public companies in India?
Some of them are. HDFC, not recommending any particular securities, is the largest publicly held one right now. I think I have to disclose that Ironhold has a position in it. Mm-hmm. SBI is the largest in the country, and it plans to go public in the next year or so.
In India?
In India, yeah.
Now, some of these, I thought HDFC used to have an ADR. Do they still have an ADR?
They might. They might.
Mm-hmm. But you guys buy the local shares.
We buy the local shares, so we don't follow ADRs so much. That's another way, actually, that individual investors can get in on certain Indian companies is through ADRs. Mm-hmm. It's not my area of expertise, but it's certainly an option.
Yeah, I just checked. HDFC does have a ADR. It's HDB is this ticker on the New York Stock Exchange. Now, that we should say that is the bank as a whole, which obviously would include the asset management unit or not.
They're actually separately traded.
India, okay. So we don't know.
Yeah, the bank spun off the mutual fund. So the mutual fund is independently traded. The bank is also a great company, and they have a really wide distribution network, which actually benefits the mutual fund. But the mutual fund is what we're really seeing growing explosively.
Very cool. India is known obviously for some of its tech prowess and IT, and we probably all know, you know, programmers who are there or from there or something. Is that an area you haven't talked about that yet, interestingly enough? IT services and things like that, is that something that is also interesting from an investing standpoint?
Certainly. Well, it is a really quickly growing sector, and it's one of India's strongest sectors, but we're also finding that it's one of the most popular in the stock market. So it receives more analyst coverage. It receives a lot more foreign investment, and we find that it's a little bit less inefficient. We're actually really interested in the more basic, like manufacturing, hard service type industries.
Very cool. Oh, that's really interesting. All right, Ethan Wydell, I want to take a short break and come back and ask you some more questions if that's all right.
But absolutely.
Let's first pause here to get a word in from our sponsors. If you are a premium subscriber, you will not get the break, so do not touch the dial. Don't go anywhere. And to become a premium subscriber, you can sign up at the website contrarian.supercast.tech.
We hope you're enjoying this episode of the Contrarian Investor Podcast, where we give voice to those who challenge a prevailing narrative in global financial markets. Consider becoming a premium subscriber. For $9 a month or less, premium subscribers receive a number of benefits. Podcasts are posted immediately after they're recorded. Transcripts are made available within 24 hours. Premium subscribers get direct access to the host and access to private channels on our Discord server. They also get generous discounts to our virtual conferences and other services. And of course, there are no ads or interruptions. Visit contrarian.supercast.tech for more information. That's contrarian.supercast.tech.
I need to tell you about Merck Research. Merckresearch.com, M-E-R-K.
I read these reports on a regular basis and can absolutely recommend them. Their research is different. They do not cherry pick positive or negative charts, nor do they fall into the trap of confirmation bias. They have an intellectually consistent approach. They grew through a consistent set of relevant data, put them through the same consistent set of frameworks, and then summarize the whole thing in a checklist with a concise written summary. And now listeners of this podcast can take advantage of a special offer, which is a 3-month free trial to Merck Research. Simply visit the website merckresearch.com, sign up for one of the subscriptions, and enter the code CONTRARIAN at checkout to take advantage of this limited offer. That's merckresearch.com, M-E-R-K.
All right, welcome back. Ethan Wydell here from Ironhold Capital Management. Ethan, this is the segment of the show where we ask our guest a little bit about his or her background, personal and more professional background, and how he or she came to this stage of his or her career. And so I'm curious how you, you say you are in Texas presently, but curious how you came to investing, how you came to Ironhold Capital, and how you came to focus on India.
Right. Well, I graduated from Columbia University with...
I've heard of it, yeah.
with a major in economics and psychology. And originally, I kind of went into the field of psychology and was more interested in that side. And through one of my classes that I was taking called Thinking and Decision Making, we were starting to talk about sort of collective irrationality as it's juxtaposed with this very economic idea of like everybody making optimal decisions. And, you know, coming from a more psychology oriented background, I was totally unfamiliar with econ. Like I had taken one class in high school and like that was it. And so I really didn't even register that there was this whole body of academics who are thinking about everything in terms of like mathematical rationality and how that should actually play out in the real world. And from there, I kind of discovered the stock market, and it's, you know, this place where there is so much irrationality and there's so much inefficiency, and, you know, not everybody actually behaves as they're supposed to. And for me, it was kind of the perfect collision of ideas. So that sort of set me on my trajectory with Ironhold Capital. I have had the pleasure of learning under Siddharth Singhai, our chief investment officer, who was a guest on the show. Yeah. And he's really the master of the Indian side of the stock market. It was something that I was unfamiliar with at the time. I've learned a tremendous amount from him and learned a lot about India as a country and as an economy and how to make money in the stock market there.
Have you been there yet?
I have not.
Cool. Well, yes,
I need to go.
Then. Yeah, it's good. It's a great experience. No question. As any of our listeners can attest who have traveled there, I'm sure. And we actually have a lot of listeners in India as well, but okay. That's really cool. So it's interesting. This idea that you talk about the irrational nature of crowds, and which is something that is unique. It's not unique actually, but it is one characteristic of stock markets, which is interesting because another one is that it's supposed to be purely rational and economic. So you have these kind of competing things. And as a contrarian investor, of course, the MO is that the narrative is often, not always, but very often false, and that there is some place to take advantage of it and to book profits if you do it right. Obviously, timing is everything. But so that's interesting. So let's go back to this idea of you're investing and investing in India and some of the sectors that you mentioned you were excited about. And you talked about manufacturing, you talked about asset management, mutual funds. What else is there?
Well, one very niche segment that we actually like quite a lot is ferroalloys, which are part of the steel manufacturing process. And steel is generally like the low growth of low growth industries. really, you know, you talk about investor narrative and like, you rarely hear much positive investor narrative about steel, but we see in India that there is, it's actually a reasonably growing industry. Steel is in general, and these ferroalloys are in particular. We see India is becoming a really viable distributor of these metals, compared to historically like China and the US and other countries that developed that area earlier.
Interesting. What are these metals used in? Is it, I assume, construction and
right, just everything steel's used in. It's a component for making steel. So one particular company that we really like is called Mython Alloys.
M-Y-T-H-O-N?
M-A-I-T-H-A-N.
Okay.
And the company is the largest producer of silicon, or sorry, manganese alloy.
Okay.
And manganese alloy is, you know, used in a variety of steel production, but basically it is the largest producer, it's the lowest cost producer, and it's been capturing market share from its competitors, which are all really enticing. And furthermore, there has been very little enthusiasm for it so far. We have roughly, you know, seen the stock price mirror earnings, but not nearly with the same enthusiasm that we see for other growing companies. And I think that that's largely because of its positioning in this little niche in Indian steel manufacturing.
Wow, that's fascinating.
Sick of me yet? Become a premium subscriber and avoid all ads or interruptions. Other benefits as well. Visit contrarian.supercast.tech for more information.
Wow, that's fascinating. I'll tell you an interesting anecdote here. I've been talking to a guy here in Connecticut about buying a house, and he says that demand for houses in this area is through the roof, presumably because people are leaving New York. But he says, interesting, and this is interesting to bring us back here to this point, is that new home construction, again, the demand is there for new homes, and so there's these developers and everybody else who wants to build it, but there is a backlog of materials. And so there is a real issue apparently, and this is according to what this guy's saying. And he's not a Wall Street guy at all. He's just a local real estate guy. But there's apparently a backlog of things that used in construction that are kind of preventing a lot of these developers from going as quickly ahead as they would like. So there you go. That would also speak to, I would think, this company's bottom line
interesting
over the near term, but that's just an anecdote. I mean, who knows what that even means. It could just be here in Connecticut too. I mean, who the hell knows, right? Yeah, so.
Absolutely. And I mean, we've seen, you know, in general, the steel industry tends to mirror the overall GDP growth.
Yeah.
As, you know, there's more development of railroads and homes and skyscrapers and everything, you know, that is pretty directly proportional with demand for steel. So there's a little bit of growth from there, not a tremendous amount. But what we find really interesting about this company is that it's actually gaining market share, and India in general is growing this sector as well. So it has two forces of growth on that side.
And is most of its market domestic or versus exports?
No, actually about 70% of this company exports globally.
Wow.
By revenue, 70% by revenue.
Mostly to the US and Europe, I would assume.
US, Europe, Australia, I think.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Very interesting. All over.
Huh. Interesting. I mean, this is certainly something that we should be paying more attention to, because, and especially nowadays, as you hear so much about there not being any investment opportunities with markets being so overvalued. Okay. That's a great one. Anything else?
Yeah. Well, I think that the idea of there not being very good opportunities because of the overvalued market and everything being really hot is true to an extent. But I think that if you're willing to look in just these really niche corners that aren't very popular, there are still a lot of companies that have yet to achieve their potential on their upside.
Yeah. Good point. Good point. Yeah. But yeah, let's go back to the mutual fund business in India. And you guys know a lot about this HDFC company and its asset management unit in particular. So tell me more about that.
Yeah. So as I think I mentioned before, discretionary income really grows in a compound way, even relative to just GDP. And India has like 6 to 7% GDP growth annually. We have seen the mutual fund industry basically quadruple, I believe, every decade. It's really, really extraordinary growth. And so these companies, which are just starting to go public, by the way, face a tremendous amount of upside because only 2 to 3% of Indian citizens actually hold shares in the stock market, compared to, you know, 50% in the United States. We see this adoption rate really starting to pick up. And as discretionary income continues to increase and GDP per capita and like the lower wages of lower wage earners begin to increase, we really anticipate to see more and more people starting to invest in mutual funds. They're picking up in assets under management, they're picking up in popularity as a percentage of people's household savings. And we think these are really great tailwinds. HDFC Asset Management Company, which is the spun off mutual fund branch of HDFC Bank, is probably our favorite example of this. They have a great distribution network. They managed to reach out to citizens from all across the country, and they have been capturing market share from some of their competitors. We were able to pick it up in 2020 as a part of our portfolio because of the COVID crash, and also because it was surpassed by SBI as the largest as the largest mutual fund in the country by assets under management, which we don't see as a huge concern. Right. It's very difficult for just anybody to set up a mutual fund. And so we don't think that there's a tremendous amount of competitive risk.
Okay.
There are only maybe five or so serious competitors in the market. So we get this kind of oligopolistic market structure where HDFC is at the top, or very near the top. And considering all of the growth tailwinds that the company faces, we think that it's the kind of company that can compound over the long run.
Nice. That sounds great. I mean, it sounds like a perfect mix because you have a barriers to entry and a huge total addressable market.
Exactly.
Right. And then the network, the distribution network to get it. I mean, that's one of the things anybody who's worked in mutual funds knows. That's one of the ways that, you know, these mutual funds are able to grow is through their distribution network. That's really interesting.
Right. And having the HDFC Bank to help foster that is really a powerful force in favor of this company.
What about M&A in India? Are there limits, I would assume, to international companies coming in there and buying local companies. Do you know anything about that?
I'm not aware of a tremendous amount of international M&A activity. I do imagine that there are limits to it. I know that there were strict limits until the 90s.
Sure.
But as the government has really drifted more towards free market economics, it has picked up a little bit. We do see a lot of M&A domestically.
Okay.
We see a lot of instances of, you know, companies acquiring smaller companies and mergers, consolidations.
Right.
It's not still at the level that we see in the United States where, you know, it's like a core fundament of corporate business. But it's absolutely a consideration. And we also see investment banks starting to take an international presence there where they facilitate this M&A process.
Right. Makes sense. That's really interesting. Okay, cool. maybe in closing, if you could tell our listeners about where they could find out more about you. I know you're pretty active on LinkedIn. I'm not sure about the other social networks or the website. How can people find you?
They can find me on LinkedIn. They can find Ironhold Capital on LinkedIn, and they can reach out to us at ironholdcapital.com.
Cool. Ironholdcapital.com. Very easy to remember. I know you guys also have a podcast and a video cast, right?
We do. Leaders in Business and Investing.
Exactly.
Slightly different scope. We talk to investment professionals.
Right. And that's on YouTube more, I think, if I'm not mistaken.
It's on YouTube. We are also on Spotify. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah. Same as me. Yeah. Very cool. All right. Well, Ethan Wydell, thank you so much for joining the Contrarian Investor Podcast today. Thank you to Ironhold Capital. Thank you all for listening. And we look forward to speaking to you again next time.
Thank you for listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. To subscribe to this podcast, simply open your favorite podcast software and search for Contrarian Investor. Follow us on social media by searching for Contrarian Investor on Twitter and Instagram. Send us your thoughts on feedback@contrarianpod.com. We look forward to speaking to you again next time.